You said your plan would cost $20.5 trillion, but other economists have said it could cost $34 trillion.
Right, okay, let me stop you right there. And we're talking trillions. You know, when the numbers are this big, they're just pretend. there ain't no Scrooge McDuck vault. Right? You ready to get red-pilled? Money doesn't exist. It's just a promise from a computer. You might as well say it costs 14 nonjillion over 12 a detan. You know, same difference.
That was Kate McKinnon playing Senator Elizabeth Warren on this weekend's Saturday Night Live, explaining how exactly to pay for Medicare for all. Hello, everyone. Matt Welch here, and welcome to a very, very special edition of the Reason Roundtable, by which I mean, as foreshadowed last week, this is the first week we can definitively announce here the splitting of our podcast streams. Where there once was just the Reason podcast, there is now three. This very Reason Roundtable, featuring four of us editors yakking about the news, which will continue appearing in your podcast app every Monday afternoon. But then, on Wednesdays, we have a new separate thing. Go subscribe to it right to the hell now. It is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, in which our leather-jacketed hero goes deep with the activists, artists, authors, entrepreneurs, newsmakers, politicians, and perhaps mimes who are making the world a freer or at least a more interesting place. And finally, our third show is the Soho Forum Debates, which contains the audio from the outstanding monthly libertarian debate series recorded live right here in New York City. We've got a brand new episode up right now, in fact, featuring our own beloved Jacob Sullum, locking horns with former New York Times reporter Alex Berenson over whether all drugs should be legal. So here's what you do. Please now whip out your phone thingy and proactively subscribe to the Soho Forum Debates and the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, or just go to Reason.com podcasts and follow the friendly neighborhood prompts. So with that, let's belatedly welcome our table rounders, the aforementioned Nick Gillespie, plus Peter Suderman and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, gang.
Hi.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Nicely done. Nick, hi. But let's go right to Suderman. Sorry. My brain is fogged. I went to the second question.
Your brain is hanging upside down.
We're all the same to you, Matt.
No.
Matt Welch goes to Bitburg.
Absolutely. Very good. This is, of all issues, should go straight to Suderman Computerman, which is to say, last week, Elizabeth Warren unveiled, finally released her plan for that, for paying for Medicare for all. So tell us what's in it, Peter, and whether math even exists.
What's in it is a bunch of hand waving and magic asterisks and what is the technically what we refer to in the world of healthcare policy as gobbledygook. it is probably the longest and most detailed of the plans she has released so far, especially if you include the analyst's letter. And there are a ton of provisions in this, and it would take a while to actually go through in detail every single one of them. The purpose of this thing, so let's start with that. What she's actually trying to do here is say, I have a way to pay for this without raising taxes on the middle class. And she went even further. Over the weekend, she gave a statement to a reporter who asked, well, how would you define the middle class? Like, what's the threshold there, right? And
because in American politics, we typically define the middle class as literally everyone who's not Jeff Bezos or on welfare.
And that is pretty much what Elizabeth Warren did.
Which was amazing.
When she responded, she was like, she said, billionaires. If you don't have $1 billion, your taxes won't go up. That is a lie interpreting her plan. It's also a lie according to the plain language of her own plan, which includes an additional surtax on people who are in the top 1% of earners. So that's people who make about $500,000 a year. Now, you might say that I think it would be completely reasonable to say that people who make $500,000 a year are not middle class. But that's not what she said. She said that it won't raise taxes on anybody who has less than $1 billion. People who make $500,000 a year most of them do not have $1 billion. So there's that. So there's the sort of the tax aspect. And then there's this other kind of the major component of what she does is she includes this thing that's sort of a payroll tax or maybe a head tax, depends on who you're talking to and who you're arguing with. And there's a big argument in the progressive Wonka sphere about whether a straightforward payroll tax would have been actually better than this kind of quasi-head tax that she includes. But basically what it says is that if you are an employer with more than 50 employees and you offer health insurance right now, you have to, instead of paying the premiums that you're paying to an insurance company right now, that is suddenly going to be converted into a tax that you will pay the government. Except she doesn't call it a tax. She calls it a Medicare contribution fee or something like that. And but it's the language in her piece is in her explanation is now you will send this money to the government. When companies are required to send money to the government, that's a tax. And when they have to do it on a per employee basis for all of their employees who make $30,000 or $50,000 or $100,000, people who we would say are middle class, then that is inevitably going to affect the middle class. So what she has here is a middle class tax hike to the tune of nearly $9 trillion, that is $9 trillion with a T, over the course of about a decade, that she is pretending is not a middle class tax hike. And then she has a whole bunch of fake savings that probably won't happen, including radically reducing the amount, overall amount that hospitals would get paid. So they would get paid a little more than Medicare rates right now. But then, but of course, there would be no more private insurance. And so she thinks she can get that through. It's very unlikely. There's a great little bit in Chuck Blahaus, Charles Blahaus, who is the former trustee of Medicare, so an actuary kind of for the program, whose like job is to sort of mind its finances. And he just says, you know, it's something like, oh, yes, most analysts regard such cuts as unrealistic. And like that's the sickest
burn.
That is the line that you could use for virtually all of the proposed savings. So she's also got, I mean, like she also sort of assumes that this thing is going to cost only an additional $20 trillion. And again, this is just like, I want to sort of marinate in the idea that we're talking about, oh, it's only $20 trillion. That's so much less than all the other estimates. And this is actually something that was referenced in that SNL clip. And I will promise I will stop after this, is that, in fact, virtually all of the other credible estimates show a plan like this costing somewhere in the low $30 trillion in additional government spending. And she's got it in the $20 trillion zone. And no one really thinks that those cuts are going to go through. No one really thinks that this is realistic. And if you just like just a final note here to give you a sense of how utterly laughable and just sort of divorced from both economic and political reality this is, one of the pay-fors that she includes, it's just a little amount in the scheme of things, about $400 billion, I believe. One of the pay-fors she includes is we'll pass comprehensive immigration reform. Oh, yeah, just as part of this, that's what we're going to do, because that's so easy, because anybody who wanted it, like people have wanted to get comprehensive immigration reform passed for how long? For as long as I've been in Washington, and it never works. And that's part of her plan. And it shows you both how desperate she is for even a small amount of additional revenue and how completely divorced from any sort of like actual practical, you know, sort of reality when it comes to paying for this. And so what she's got is a plan that is designed to make it look like she has a plan, not a plan that is an actual plan designed to work.
Wow.
But she's got all the plans, right? She's the serious candidate with all the plans.
That's what Paul Krugman says. So
I will say I'm slightly heartened by the fact that there have been a bunch of liberals and lefty types who have at least raised a sort of skeptical eyebrow. There was a piece in Slate by Jordan Weissman. The headline was something like, Elizabeth Warren's plan to pay for Medicare for all is not exactly realistic. Or maybe not. No, it was not entirely realistic.
Here, can I ask you a question, Peter? Because you mentioned Chuck Blahaus, and he, for Mercatus, he came out with an earlier critique of Medicare for All.
It was a cost estimate at $32 trillion, which actually is...
It was a critique. Peter, sure. please, come on. It was not a brief for, nor was it a non-ideological intervention into the debate over healthcare, right?
Sure. Although his numbers actually broadly align with the Urban Institute's numbers. And the Urban Institute is a left-leaning think tank.
What I was going to ask is, why do Medicare for All people lose the debate when they say, and this is, you know, in using Blahouse's numbers, they pointed out, and Bernie Sanders is still talking about this, that when you look at the amount of money that the private sector that is going to go towards healthcare that is projected forward, you know, 30 or 50 years, basically, you know, what they're talking about, they're not talking about spending more for Medicare for All. They're just saying it's all going to be done through the public sector rather than a mix of public dollars and private dollars. So the overall spending on healthcare is not going to go up. It's just that you'll be paying for it for taxes, but you won't have any out-of-pocket costs. Why is that so hard for people like Elizabeth Warren to get behind, and why is it wrong? Because I do think it's wrong, but, you know, why do they shy away from that?
Actually, that is an argument that Elizabeth Warren has been making.
That's what she said in the debates, basically.
That's what she's been saying in the debates, and that's also what she says in her outline here, although she makes a smaller claim than some of the people who have pointed to Blahouse's initial cost estimate showing a $32 trillion additional cost for Medicare for All. So she says that total United States healthcare spending will be just over $52 trillion over the next decade if we do nothing, right, and that if we adopt her plan and her financing method, it would be just under $52 trillion. So a fairly small total savings. Again, this is her plan, as with Bernie Sanders' plan, rely on completely unrealistic assumptions that no credible economist, maybe not no credible economist, but very few credible economists really buy, or at least buy altogether as a package, about how you can reduce total spending on healthcare, mostly by forcing down payments on hospitals and providers. And right, so there's a big focus whenever you hear lefties talk about Medicare for All. Well, you know, they'll talk about drug companies and they'll talk about insurance companies. But drug companies and insurance companies just aren't where the money is. Now, if you want to squeeze some total savings, and again, we're going to talk about, when I say total savings, what I'm talking about is both public and private spending on healthcare in the United States, right? If you lumped them all together, and the government spends a little more than half of the healthcare dollars in the United States right now already. But if you wanted to do it, if you wanted to get some total savings, you could get a little bit out of the drug companies and a little bit out of insurers. But mostly it's going to have to come from hospitals and to a lesser extent from doctors. And Elizabeth Warren does make that sort of clear in her plan. She says, well, what we're going to do is we're going to pay 110% of Medicare rate. So that's an increase in the rate that they're getting, obviously, from current Medicare. But remember that most hospitals get a mix of payers. It's not just Medicare or just Medicare and Medicaid. They're paid also by private insurers. And private insurers are paying something like 200, even 240% of Medicare rates in some places. Obviously, it varies state by state, insurer by insurer, hospital by hospital. But private insurers are paying a lot more. And so that would represent a massive cut to hospitals in terms of their total revenue. What happens when you radically cut hospital spending? Well, either they start putting people in lines, some combination of there starts rationing, and right, and so you get long
death
lines.
Death panels.
Yeah, it's not death panels, but then you have less resources. Basically, you have less resources to work with, and so they either fire a lot of people or they you know, put people in lines. They reduce the amount of services they offer, whatever it is, and that's. They close in some cases, and in fact, there's a real risk that if you adopted Medicare for All and these sorts of payment rates, that rural hospitals that struggle in particular would end up either closing or substantially reducing the services they offer. And so it's just that nobody really thinks this is very realistic, and nobody really thinks that you can actually implement these sorts of cuts and just make this shift, especially in the very short time frame that the Sanders plan that Warren supposedly supports calls for.
So this is 4 years. Once again, on this podcast, we find ourselves, or at least I find myself, in the weird position of being like, you know who's actually pretty right about this? Nancy Pelosi.
Yes.
Here we are again this weekend. Nancy Pelosi says, I'm reading the Bloomberg headline. Nancy Pelosi says she's, quote, not a big fan of Medicare for All. And then the subhead is, says many Americans worry about loss of private insurance. And then expanding Medicare would be expensive, comma, House Speaker says. Like, that's the critique. There are many other critiques, but like all those words that Peter just said are super important and valuable. But this is like Nancy Pelosi's analysis is the correct analysis of why none of these numbers are real and this plan is not real.
There's another aspect of why it's not real that I should just bring up because it's actually pretty important, which is that Warren's, in addition to this quasi head tax, payroll tax thing on employers, she's also got a bunch of new taxes on rich people. And that includes people who are making $500,000 a year, you know, as bankers or lawyers or whatever, as well as people who are really quite well off. If she expands her wealth tax on billionaires. And so there are additional taxes on billionaires, and the taxes get to the point where you would just absolutely spark a huge amount of tax avoidance. And I mean, when you're talking about a 6% tax on wealth that just continues over time until the supply dwindles and dwindles and dwindles and dwindles down, people who have a lot of money, one of the things they do with their money is spend it on keeping their money. And so there's just no question. I mean, there's articles about this already. There's no question that you would see a lot of very rich people find ways to park their money elsewhere out of Elizabeth Warren's reach. I think some of the kind of the financial world billionaire class criticisms of Elizabeth Warren are perhaps a little bit overblown. But at the same time, she is coming for their fortunes. She's made that very clear. And what she's going to and what they are going to do in response, in part, they're going to make fun of Elizabeth Warren and gripe about her, but partly they're going to use all available legal methods to shield that money from taxation.
I think the least convincing element of Elizabeth Warren's candidacy is her insistence that Ballers on HBO is her favorite TV show, which also came up for a joke on Saturday Night Live.
I kind of believe her.
Ballers is on at like 9 o'clock or something, so she's already
asleep.
It's on
HBO, it's on all the time, every time.
If you think that Elizabeth Warren is using like HBO Go, I think you
She definitely is, because like inveighs against all of the joys of monopolistic modernity. She absolutely is a consumer of them. Also, Ballers is pretty good, not going to lie.
I'm looking at a list of, you know, the top candidates. It's Trump, Biden, Sanders, and Warren, and none of them is using, you know, more than, you know, anything more than a jitterbug.
She probably doesn't pay for her own HBO.
I mean, I strongly suspect that she's just watching because she views The Rock as a potential competitor and doesn't and wants to know what his game plan is.
As well she should.
What I was going to say about all four of these people is that, you know, and Peter, thinking about the healthcare debate, one of the things that doesn't come out, and I was talking to some people, some liberal Democrats, actually, over the weekend, and we all were talking about what's odd is when you talk about healthcare and other things, that nobody is talking about increasing the supply of medicine or of healthcare or of health provision. And in almost every other area, one of the ways, and you also see this in education when people talk about the rising costs of college, almost nobody talks about increasing the supply of education to drive down prices. Bernie Sanders is talking about putting in a national rent control thing. Each of these candidates, in their way, they are so old school and old fashioned and looking backwards, where it's about managing demand in whatever market they think is misbehaving or misperforming, as opposed to just opening things up. And in healthcare, it seems like that's the clearest place where if you took off some of the regulations, if you took off some of the licensing stuff, if you took off all of these types of things, you would get a profusion of new ways of delivering new and different and innovative forms of healthcare, which is happening, but could be happening, you know, at 100 miles an hour rather than 20 miles an hour. And to me, this is why this election is particularly sad, is that, you know, it is going to be, I would predict that it's one of those four people, Trump, Biden, Sanders, or Warren, is going to be elected in 2020. And they are not the beginning of something new. They are hopefully the end of something that we've been, you know, just roaming around in these ruins of a once great American political consensus that has been dead and decayed for, you know, 20, 30, even 40 years.
The Trump administration did deregulate short-term limited duration health insurance. And so STDLI health insurance is not a term that most of you have encountered or need to.
I keep that health
just
insurance.
Just the STD part.
I keep that health insurance in my skiff.
STLDI.
You don't even know.
Short-term limited, short-term limited duration health insurance. But basically, these are plans that have a sort of an end date, and the Trump administration allowed you to kind of string these plans together. They're less regulated and thus less expensive. They cover less as well, but often they're the right option for people for a certain type of people in a certain situation at a certain time. They are the best alternative for some people. And the Trump administration has made cheaper insurance available to some people as a result. And so even that, right, it's not exactly a supply in the health care, right? It's not doctors, but it is a thing that you couldn't buy that has been before that has been deregulated and has largely been a success. And if you look, you know, people were warning, including I thought that this had the possibility of destabilizing the Obamacare exchanges. And in fact, premiums have gone down for typical plans in the Obamacare exchanges for 2 years now. And really those markets look healthier than ever. The Trump administration, for all of it, the, you know, complaints about people trying to sabotage Obamacare over the last couple of years, certainly Republicans did try to repeal it in 2017, but the Trump administration's management of it from HHS, somewhat discounting the lawsuit that they're involved in right now where they're refusing to defend it. But the management of that program has actually been arguably better than President Obama's, and those exchange markets look healthier. I'm not going to say that Obamacare is working great and is a great program, but it seems to be working better than it was under President Obama.
Catherine, I was going to go to you with a, hey, look, even the liberal Saturday Night Live is acknowledging the reality or the waving of reality of math. But then right as we were playing the clip, you said you woke up this morning and saw the whole SNL clip and it made you furious. Why did it make you so furious, Kevin?
I was furious at you for making me watch that first thing in the morning. I agree that actually that was a not unfair presentation, especially considering the source. But man, that was just like a terrible way to start my day. It's true. Like, I do not expect that Saturday Night Live will be the home of hard-hitting anti-Elizabeth Warren political commentary. I mean, this is the same.
This really wasn't.
But given that this is the same place, and in fact, I believe the same actress who, like, upon Hillary Clinton's loss, like, donned a white suit and mournfully sang Leonard Cohen for the country, like, given that context, I think that, you know, she's still obviously meant to be hero guy of that sketch. At the same time, there were, at least she was like, hey, yeah, the numbers aren't real. Like, that
but
is that, true. And
so,
that
so I actually want to
say it out loud as a joke,
that.
But she still said it out loud.
Yes. So she said that out loud. And if you listen to how that whole response in the middle of the clip plays out, she's talking about how it's just money is just numbers promised you from a computer. She is channeling modern monetary theory, MMT, which is, yes, this is actually a bunch of their argument is that
people who are not currently engaged in the modern monetary theory debate are not going to hear that and think, gosh, that was an interesting articulation of MMT. They're going to think, yeah, that's dumb. Money is real.
Catherine, everyone is currently engaged in the modern monetary theory
whether they
debate.
Want to be or not.
Yeah, that's we all are. That's the national debt. That's all of these healthcare programs. That's the whole thing. Like, you can't escape MMT. Coming for you.
All I'm saying is I'm grading on a curve, and Kate McKinnon doing a lady presidential candidate, I did not expect it to be a brutal evisceration of the plan. I was pleasantly surprised. At least some objections were raised and semi-acknowledged.
The 6.5 minute clip was kind enough to her and unfunny enough that The Atlantic wrote it up as, this is kind of a campaign ad for Elizabeth Warren, and we're not sure where the jokes are.
No.
Anybody watching that, and this is where comedians, if they're actually funny, and Kate McKinnon is nothing if not funny, like, they end up, whatever their biases might be or who they want to win the election, nobody walks away from that saying, like, Elizabeth Warren, she's a good-natured, you know, happy woman. It's a damning portrait of her.
I wouldn't go with damning, but yeah, it wasn't.
Yes.
I mean, I think what we're hearing here.
She is one step away from Joe
Biden.
What we're hearing here is that this is
a Rorschach blot, which is how all campaign, everything is forever and ever. Amen. See footnote, Jonathan Haidt.
Nick, one thing that you are fond of saying in moments like this, especially when we talk about Medicare, is that, hey, man, did you know that actually Medicare kind of sucks? What do you mean by that when you say that? Because, I mean, it feels like Medicare for All is like this, is this prize that everyone's lining up against in the Democratic field. And yet it might not be all that.
Medicare is great if you are the recipient of it, because you're getting something that, depending on the analysis and what you're consuming, you're paying maybe 40 cents on the dollar for the care you're getting, which is virtually unlimited. So it's great if you're over 65, but that happens to be a relatively small portion of people in America. And the rest of us are paying into a system that will not exist in any way. If it exists at all, when we try to tap into it, it won't resemble what it is now. So it's easy to say to the recipient of a program, you know, oh, yeah, this is a great, you know, a recipient can say this is a great program. That doesn't mean it's a good program, because you got to look at costs as well as benefits. And then beyond that, there are various analyses of, like, you know, does Medicare actually extend the quality and the life of the people who are on it? And it's not at all clear, because there's obviously a lot of background noise. People are living longer for all sorts of reasons. So the idea that Medicare, you know, other things like the Marshall Plan or the GI Plan, the GI Bill and stuff like that, or the Apollo program, we're often told, just, you know, as an aside, that these are wonderful examples of government programs, large scale government programs that, you know, just are universally hailed as good things. When you start digging into them, it gets a lot more complicated a lot more quickly. Medicare is not a good program when you look at the costs and benefits.
There was an interesting study done maybe a decade or so ago that looked at the introduction of Medicare and its effect on mortality in seniors. So that's basically, did seniors live longer after they got a gigantic healthcare benefit? And there was no, after all the adjustments were made and after they looked at this, there was no discernible effect. It is not clear. Now, this is, again, so this isn't a gold standard RCT study, because to do that, you'd have to have a randomized trial. And that's just a very difficult thing to do, although they did it with Medicaid in Oregon and found basically the same results. But the best study we have on comparing sort of the trajectory and the break right at when Medicare is introduced. And again, this is Medicare in the late 1960s and early 1970s. It's a somewhat different program at that point. So it's not perfect. I don't want to say that this study is the be all end all, but the best evidence we have is that Medicare doesn't do the most basic thing that you would want a program like this to do if you think of it as a health program rather than simply as a sort of a financial smoothing program. It doesn't do the most basic thing, which is extend, make people live longer.
This also gets to, I think, like a broader confusion in this debate, which is on purpose, between health insurance and health care. The rates of having health insurance are not actually the most important thing. And the fact that we can't and don't talk at all about the ways people could or should consume healthcare outside of the insurance system or in a complementary way to the insurance system is because that makes an already difficult conversation, see Peter's like 27 minutes at the top of this podcast, even more difficult. But the idea that having health insurance in some way directly equates to having good health, it is a purposeful confusion that people have been encouraging for decades in this conversation, and it's currently getting worse, right? Medicare for All does not mean like eternal life for all, and that is certainly the way that many people are rounding it up.
A final thing I should add in here is that it's probable that one of the major components in her plan for financing Medicare for All is unconstitutional.
Heyo.
She takes $6 trillion in state money that is currently being spent on state healthcare programs. So under Medicare for All, it wipes out all existing healthcare programs, including, to be clear, today's Medicare program, because it's a different program. It's not just Medicare, but for everyone. It's a different kind of insurance. And so in wiping it out, what she's trying to do is reclaim the money that the states are spending on mostly on Medicaid, and it's about $6 trillion. And so she includes this thing called a maintenance of effort requirement that basically says states will be required to give this money to the federal government. Well, one of the things that the federal government can't do is commandeer state funds. And so it's not a slam dunk case, but there's a very strong case to be made that this would run afoul of the Constitution. And in some ways, the same way that the Medicaid expansion in the Affordable Care Act in Obamacare ran afoul of the Constitution. And that was one of the outcomes of the challenge. One of the big challenges to Obamacare was that states actually couldn't be forced to expand Medicaid through Obamacare, and that's why some states are now expansion states, but not every state has gone along and done that. And so under that logic, it would be very difficult to see. Certainly there would be a challenge, and it is quite likely, I think, that the Supreme Court would rule against Elizabeth Warren's plan and say that she has violated a kind of fundamental principle of the Constitution, which is that the federal government can't just tell states what to do.
One of the benefits maybe of this election season coming up, really, and you know, is it provides in very clear-cut ways and in across the political spectrum, really, of kind of an old model of command and control politics. And there's a Trumpian version of this and a Warren version and a Sanders version and even a Biden version that they are just bankrupt. And when you know, Warren can sound pretty good until she has to start explaining.
Philosophically as well as economically.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. Like the economics come later and, you know, it seems engaging or, you know, and attractive. Oh, well, you know what? We can just come up with a great plan and it'll do this, that, and the other thing. And then when you start to say, well, yeah, but how do we already have something like that? How do we scale it up? How do we pay for it? And you realize it's totally unfeasible. And that should go back and get people to start thinking about philosophically, we need a different type of politics. And just as Trump is not going to produce massive numbers of manufacturing jobs by doing trade wars, and he's not going to stop illegal immigration via a wall, you know, we need different types of policies. That's also true in the provision of things like healthcare, education, retirement. And it's a really old phrase from the H.W. Bush administration that was attributed to Jim Pinkerton, but we need a new paradigm for politics. And one, Matt, you'll recognize this line of thinking from the Declaration of Independence, but, you know, we need a new, we need a way that talks more about unleashing innovation and an open-ended access to things rather than trying to take a certain amount of goods and services and then parceling them out in the way that we find either politically or, you know, economically or philosophically congruent with our beliefs. We need to be changing the markets and just opening stuff up to all kinds of weird, interesting experiments rather than trying, you know, to breathe more life into the dying embers of 20th century politics.
Speaking of open-ended innovation, one of our recurring themes here on the Reason Roundtable podcast, and note the reinforcement of that branding, is the ongoing government versus social media panic, which seems to generate headlines, multiple headlines, every week. Nick, you wrote at least two pieces last week just talking about recent developments. Can you walk us through some of the lowlights that we've seen recently among our media and political class as it comes to big social media and big tech?
There is a certain type of unanimity. And again, this covers the traditional political spectrum from, you know, the right to the left or conservative to liberal, saying that we need to rein in that. First off, that big tech and particularly big media, social media now, is a problem that needs to be addressed by the government. And so you have people like Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley on the right. You have people like Elizabeth Warren and others on the left, or on the liberal end of things, saying we need to break up or regulate the way that media gets done in a post-broadcast network era. That's problematic. You have increasingly the heads of the different tech platforms, a year ago and 2 years ago, you had every major person from companies such as Google and YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and Twitter come to Congress and say in one way or the other, it's time to regulate. We want to help you regulate us for the common good. And, that it will help us, in our bottom line, that's something, but it's not the thing we want to lead with. You're starting to see some fracturing in that. I think politicians are still looking for ways to kind of either bully or actually legislate places like Twitter and Facebook to their advantage and to their partisan advantages. But then you see a split most recently between Mark Zuckerberg on Facebook and Jack Dorsey at Twitter of how are they going to deal with political advertising in the 2020 election. And Zuckerberg seems to be finding his faith again, kind of going through a new baptism of being a free speech person, whereas Jack Dorsey has basically said Twitter is not going to allow political advertising. We're still a week or so out from their final guidelines. So you see in this, an interesting split. And then you see people like, older school people who have been in journalism and in the government, like Richard Stengel, who was a managing editor of Time. He was the head of the National Constitution Center, and he was a diplomat, a State Department undersecretary for Obama, saying we need state level hate speech laws because free speech has gone too far. And I think what is kind of sizing up now is, an argument between free speech and First Amendment rights versus people who feel like it's all gone too far. It's a fight that we should be engaging in because I think we'll win.
I'm enjoying the contretemps between Aaron Sorkin and Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
Particularly this last week's round of it in which Sorkin wrote, I think, a pretty terrible op-ed about
heavily corrected.
It had to be correct. Letter. Yeah. If you want to go always careful with the journalistic schadenfreude, but go enjoy the corrections on that fella because it was factually wrong in a bunch of ways. And Zuckerberg,
including the year his own movie about Facebook came out.
Correct. Yep. That was a nice one. Zuckerberg just basically shitposting on Facebook in response a quote from an Aaron Sorkin movie.
From the American president.
From the American president.
It's the climactic monologue about how free speech is the most important thing.
And how, sometimes you just gotta let speech that makes your blood boil exist, because that's really what it means to be American. Extremely delicious to me, just the whole thing back and forth. Meanwhile, we also have a truly unholy alliance of everybody's most hated nanny state liberal, Chuck Schumer of New York, joining forces with everybody's most hated nanny state conservative, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, to ask for an investigation of TikTok because the Chinese. Now,
the red Chinese.
The red Chinese. Yeah, now, we have actually written about, I think there actually is good reason to believe that TikTok may be censoring some content that the Chinese government would not like to see, especially stuff about the Hong Kong protests, which should be all over TikTok based on all other kind of demographic understandings of who's on that platform. But I have to say, you just have to be against literally anything that brings together Tom Cotton and Chuck Schumer. I will stand on that principle. I will.
Well, it's worth thinking about. And again, this is all pre-partisan, but the axis that is being revealed by the 2020 election and recent events is one that is not right or left. It's authoritarian and libertarian. And it doesn't mean that Schumer or Tom Cotton are, authoritarian in the way that the Beijing government is, but they want more control over the way that people are allowed to live and what we're allowed to say, what we're allowed to think, what we're allowed to buy, how we're allowed to build our houses, run our businesses, et cetera, versus a libertarian dimension, which is, let's loosen it up a little bit. And, you know, what has happened, you know, and this is partly because of a really bad media narrative and a political narrative about the 2008 financial crisis and a variety of other things, including, you know, the way that big tech has been complicit in, you know, widespread state surveillance and things like that leading up to the financial crisis, what was considered a kind of libertarian capitalism and a free society came, you know, under a lot of attack. But what's being revealed now, I think, is that, you know, we brushed aside the idea that a libertarian direction to American society, including culture, including politics, including business and globalization, you know, we kind of shunted that aside too quickly because we thought whether it was Obama or whether we think it's Donald Trump or whether we think it's whoever is going to be able to regulate things in a way that will make our lives easier and consistently put my preferences at the front of everybody. You know, that doesn't work that way. So, you know, this is really where, you know, we need to be making a big stink because if nothing else, I think, you know, libertarian sensibilities are being proven right on a daily basis in the news.
I would like to offer a partial defense of Jack Dorsey's decision to ban political ads on Twitter. It seems like maybe something you could quibble with, but it's really of a different kind than the other sorts of things we're talking about here because this is a private platform, and what he's doing is simply saying, we won't sell this product. He's not saying, he's not banning anybody from the platform. Politicians are still welcome to have accounts and tweet whatever they want, and you can follow them or not follow them. I mean, in his, we don't have the complete guidelines yet, but what he has basically said is, what he says in his at the end of his tweet storm about this, of course, is how he announced it, is this isn't about free expression. This is about paying for reach. And so what he's doing is saying that the business that I own is not going to sell a product, which is political ads that are designed to get into the timelines of people who don't already subscribe to a particular account about this or to a particular politician's account. And again, I think you can quibble with that. I think you can say, well, maybe a political discourse would be better if he did. But it isn't a First Amendment issue. It isn't even really a big free speech issue. It is a decision not to sell a product for political reasons, but in order to make his product, the thing that he owns, the thing that he runs, he believes it will be a better place to discuss things if those ads don't exist.
I don't disagree with you in your particulars that this is not technically a First Amendment issue. It is a free speech issue, I think, and it's a larger culture of free speech. There's no question he is doing this out of political considerations, not out of economic or business concerns. But more importantly, it raises a bunch of questions about the promise of new media that I think, you know, our new media or social media, however you want to call it, is being recuperated into a broadcast model where he's saying people who don't want to see it, you already have a way of getting rid of stuff in your Twitter timeline that you don't want to see, which is that you block it. And it would be easy enough for him to create better or more robust tools for the end user to design their experience the way they want. He's also sloughing over. So what happens if, you know, a Twitter influencer gets paid by a politician
This is actually the point raise is I think
it starts raising all sorts of issues that are elegantly avoided by simply saying, you know what, we're going to open it up more rather than less. We don't even have to settle everything. But what we are going to do is have more speech and give you more tools to create the environment that you want to experience Twitter in. And I wish that he was doing more of that. He's also, you know, and it just doesn't seem like he's interested in that. I think Zuckerberg is coming back to this religion, this, you know, free speech religion, partly because he has been named, you know, explicitly by Elizabeth Warren, as well as by other politicians to say, you know what, we are coming for you. If we get elected or if we get a majority, we are going to break you up. And so his feet are a little more to the fire. But it's that broader question of a culture of free speech and culture of free expression and open exchange, you know, not without boundaries and not without ways to control it or tamp it down if you're not comfortable with certain things. But it's that larger culture of free speech, which really needs to be revivified.
I guess I just think that part of a culture of free speech is people who own businesses and platforms, some of which sell speech, can have the right. And in some cases, you know, in some sense, even the obligation to decide what sorts of speech products
you know
they are going to sell.
None of the big concerns about, you know, speech and political action on, well, I was going to say on social media come from ads. Oh, there's too many ads. You know, it's the stuff that it doesn't present itself as ads. So Dorsey is actually kind of, you know, routing around the actual issue or the elephant in the room.
Catherine?
The thing that Dorsey is going to end up doing, though, is duplicating the mistakes of campaign finance restriction on the public side on a private platform. We have discovered, to zero surprise, that it's really, really, really difficult to make categories of speech and to sharply maintain them. That what is political speech? What is campaign speech? What is electioneering? And we have tried. We have just pages and pages and pages and pages of legal language to help us make those distinctions. People remain confused and people continue to very, very effectively route around any restrictions that are created on the legal level. Now, Peter is right that this is not a First Amendment thing. I do think, however, the mechanisms of enforcement are going to be, they're going to have to be extremely complex. And the minute that we get complexity on social media platforms with how some speech is or isn't presented, we immediately get conspiracy theories. And what is going to happen is that we will have a dramatic uptick in conservative complaining about shadow banning. We will probably also somehow have a dramatic uptick in liberal complaining about hate speech. And in the end, I find it very unlikely that Twitter will actually be meaningfully depoliticized in any way. So I think there's just a third point here, which is like, should it be legal? Yes. Is it a good idea? Nick says no. Peter says maybe. I say maybe. But then can they even do it? And I am deeply skeptical that implementation of this will be even remotely successful in its stated aims.
I definitely don't think that Twitter will end up depoliticized as a result of this. And I also, but I also don't think that that's really the goal. The goal here, at least according to Dorsey, and I actually think this is not completely crazy or ridiculous. Perhaps it's not going to work super well, but I don't think it's crazy. What he says is the goal is for political ideas, you can't pay for reach. So you just, it has to be organic. And that's all he's trying to prevent is you pay me. You cannot pay me, Jack Dorsey, who owns Twitter, in order to reach more people for your political ideas. You're welcome to spread them as far as you can organically.
Right. That closely mirrors the thinking behind campaign finance.
Yes, I agree. There are definitely practical problems with implementation, Peter Sudeman
and
said.
Broader than that, it's, you know, paying for political speech is a way that people who don't have name recognition or official party organizations behind them and things like that built things.
The place that this ends
that have
is Citizens
built
United.
Into the system.
The place that this ends is like a private sector variant of Citizens United. And that decision, while I think rightly decided, was also insanely polarizing and people remain confused about it to this day.
I wrote in one of the pieces, Matt, that I wrote about this last week at Reason.com. I mentioned or in some conversation related to that, in 1980, Ed Clark of the Libertarian Party paid for like a 13-minute infomercial. It was one of the few ways he could get media attention, and he bought, you know, time on broadcasts and, you know, local channels and things like that. And over the years I've met dozens of people who said, you know, that's how they first heard about libertarian ideas. I like that. I like paid advertising. I like it especially when it's called paid advertising, because I know, you know, it gives me a context in which to consume it, and I can turn it off. And I find Dorsey, in the way that he talked, and Peter, I read that all with interest and with a lot of sympathy for him, but there is something about demonizing paid speech or political speech, the way that he talks about it, that I find inimical to what the internet used to be all about. And it doesn't mean the internet doesn't change meaning and all of that, but it could be more open, it could be less open. Dorsey is coming out in favor of a less open public arena of free speech, and that troubles me.
And we can have and we can expect to have people who work for campaigns whose job it is to write pro Elizabeth Warren Twitter messages on Twitter full time. That's their job. They get paid 100 grand a year. I'm making this job up, but let's pretend that, that it exists exactly like that. And what's the freaking difference is what I'm saying. But since Nick referenced Libertarian Party, I'm going to use that as a segue into the what we are all consuming, because my entrant in that is I consumed? No, I participated in the South Carolina Libertarian Party convention, conference, et cetera, and presidential debate, which I moderated there. And after the moderation of said debate, I ended up talking with a whole bunch of libertarians, many of whom like discovered the LP in 1978 because they read an ad in the back pages of Reason, or who told hilarious Bob Poole stories and other types of things. As always, when I go to gatherings like that, it's super awesome. And I speak for all the editors in chief on this podcast. Like, the best part about the job is to meet people who tell us stories about, you know, encountering the magazine back when Peter Suderman was still in diapers. Super great, very fun. But so what I wanted to report from said Libertarian Party debate, couple things. One, there's a new entrant into the presidential 2020 presidential sweepstakes over there. Jacob Hornberger threw his hat in the ring over the weekend. Did not participate in the debate because he was a latecomer there.
Can you explain who?
Yeah, he's the founder of the Future.
Who Bumper Hornberger is?
The Future of Freedom, the Future of American Freedom. What is it again?
FFF,
the Future of Freedom of Friends, long time anti-war advocate or activist for a very long time, and a promoter of how he described as sort of like unapologetic libertarianism abroad and at home, including he's a big open borders advocate. But anyways, he's thrown his hat in the ring. I would describe the current state of the Libertarian Party presidential campaign as emphasis seems to be so far on representing the libertarian wing of the Libertarian Party as a kind of response to the perceived too many nods in the direction of centrism over years past, which of course also led to record levels of voting for said more centristy libertarians. So it'll be interesting to see who else comes in and how things fall out. But having said that, now, Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I have been consuming, like many people, the OK Boomer meme this week. And like Taylor Lorenz, who is one of our faves here, I think this is maybe her first piece for The Times.
If not her first piece, one of her early pieces
since her new perch at The New York Times has begun. It is just very quickly for the boomers out there listening who might not know about it. It is basically just a catch-all dismissive term for anyone older than like late millennial. So, for instance, all of Gen X is included in the OK Boomer meme. And it's meant to capture generational differences, stuff like, you know, owning a printer. Like, the if you were to casually mention printing something, the correct response would be okay boomer,
or knowing how to use the mail,
knowing how to send a letter. Okay, you know, kids these days don't know how to send a letter. Okay boomer, that's the correct response. You know, how come kids these days don't know how to write in cursive, meanwhile like calling your grandchildren because you're too many emails is making your computer real slow? Okay boomer. I am enjoying this meme in part because I'm like two-thirds absolutely in solidarity with the users of the meme and one-third, oh shit, I'm a boomer in this taxonomy, which first of all, like, that's just fair, like bridge generation realness. But also the one that hit me the hardest, which maybe y'all will appreciate, is boomer culture is having such a storied, rock solid employment history that you use your professional email for personal purposes sometimes. And I was like, ouch, oh, that is the boomerist thing that I do. And I feel attacked.
Okay, boomer. Nick, what are you consuming?
So I'm reading Dan Carlin's The End Is Always Near. And it's a kind of prolonged meditation on past moments of kind of apocalyptic events, including the Spanish flu, fears of nuclear holocaust, and kind of wipeouts of large parts of civilization. It's a pretty interesting book. I'm happy to say he's going to be actually interviewing him for a future episode of the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie podcast. So people, please sign up for that. Subscribe at reason.com/podcasts. To all of our streams, and that one will show up automatically in your inbox. And I've also been watching BoJack Horseman on Netflix, which features in its latest season an anti-capitalist turn about kind of media and commercial conglomeration, which is kind of funny given that it's a Netflix release, which is, along with Amazon, gobbling up everything that is new and wonderful and good in the movie-making, television, and streaming
sphere. I just want to note Dan Carlin is not, in fact, paying for these ad placements, in case anyone is worried about that. It's
absolutely
just
not.
Back-to-back yeah. Dan Carlin endorsements from me and Nick.
Suderman, what's your Dan Carlin that you've been consuming?
I watched Terminator Dark Fate, which is the sixth Terminator movie. And it, like all of the Terminator films except the first two, it's an attempt to reboot the series. I would not say it's entirely successful. It's not a great movie. It kind of rehashes a lot of the beats from Terminator 2 in particular, but what is great about it is that it brings back Linda Hamilton, who was the kind of the heart and emotional center of the first two films, the only two that are really truly great, two of the best action movies I think really ever made. And Hamilton is just phenomenal in it. She's sort of funny and bleak and just owns the screen and pulls off both some sort of some quite goofy comic moments. The movie is directed by the guy who directed Deadpool, and so there's a little bit of awkward, there's some sort of almost meta humor that gets sort of stuffed in to the movie. At one point, we find out that the Terminator has been living a life as a drapery salesman. But Linda Hamilton's in it, and like she has to do all right. She has to be both a badass action hero as well as like an incredibly sad and depressed like older woman who has lost a child. And so it's not a great movie, but it's kind of fascinating the way that it continues the really interesting gender identity explorations that were in. That were core to the first two Terminator films and all of the James Cameron movies from that era, in that this is a movie built, this is a giant movie, you know, a $200 million action film that is built on a trio of female leads and maternal grief. And so I can't quite recommend it in the theater, but if you're a fan of the franchise, it's something that is probably worth going back to once it hits cable or streaming.
That is all the gender identity exploration that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable. Again, to echo Nick Gillespie, go to reason.com/podcasts and subscribe to the very excellent Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and also the Soho Forum debates there. And otherwise, keep on listening to us here on Mondays. And thank you for it. Bye.
Sorry, Senator, I'm going to need to see the math on that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you want to see the math? Okay, I'll show you. Look at this. Here. Do you understand this? I do. I could explain it to you, but you'd die.
Okay!